is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been no picnic trying to keep up with the news about trade, NAFTA, the Asia-Pacific Economic Forum, and now GATT. We're going to take a step back from the often headache-inducing details of the trade talks and look at related parts of the big economic picture. My guest James Fallows has written a series of articles in the Atlantic Monthly about the American economic system and how it compares with the systems of our Asian competitors. The final article is published in the January edition. The articles are adapted from his forthcoming book, More Like Us, The Rise of the Asian System, which will be published in early 1994. Fallows is Washington editor of the Atlantic Monthly and a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. Trade talks used to be considered about the most boring news imaginable, but for months they've been dominating the headlines. Is this just coincidence or is something fundamentally changing?
In one way, it is coincidence that three of these deadlines came within about a month. The NAFTA vote, the meeting in Seattle where President Clinton saw the Asian representatives, and the deadline for the negotiations on GATT. And so that's what's producing this burst of news about what is still, even now, a fairly boring topic. But I think something I say this to somebody who spent more of his life than he wants trying to deal with it. But there is something, I think, more fundamental that's changing, too. And it has to do with the way these issues are discussed. Usually, trade issues have been reserved more or less for the weenies in one group, the sort of the people who would talk over what provision of this tariff was going to be reduced by what percent, and those who talk about it in kind of grand sweeping principles, that free trade was always by definition good, people who were violating it were in some way cheating, if we didn't have free trade, we're going to have the Great Depression and the Smoot-Hawley laws, et cetera, et cetera. What's interesting to me is a shift in basic terms of discussion. In the NAFTA debate, you had a considerable number of Americans saying, yeah, this will be freer trade, but we're worried about what it'll do to our industrial structure. In the GATT talks, you have not Americans saying that, but largely, say, French people saying it, saying, yeah, free trade is fine, but what about our farmers? What about our movie producers, et cetera, et cetera? And this, in ways we can get on to discuss in a minute, I think is leading to some kind of deep change in discussions of trade issues.
You have a very interesting article in the January edition of Atlantic Magazine, and the article is called What is an Economy For? And in it, you compare the economic system of Asian countries and the economic system of America, and you find very fundamental differences that you don't think America has really started seriously dealing with yet.
Perhaps you'd like me to explain these differences.
Yes, well, I thought I'd take them one by one. Let's start with one of those differences. You say that in the United States, we measure the health of the economy by the consumer standard of living. But the goal of the Asian economic model is to increase the collective national strength. Can you elaborate on these differences?
Yes. What I had in mind there is that almost anybody who studied economics in an English-speaking country, mainly the U.S. and Britain, or who reads economic columns in the papers, knows that what we think economic progress is for is so that we'll have a higher standard of living as individuals. We want trade barriers to go down so that imported goods will be cheaper. And we want competition because that will drive quality up and price down and blah, 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 blah. This is everything we're taught in economics course. It seemed to me, after living in and reporting in Asia for now the last 7 years, that the basic motive there was not one you could find in our economic textbooks, but you would find instead in history textbooks. And what you would find there is that the moral, the lesson of the last, you know, 4 or 5 centuries from the Asian point of view, is that other societies who were materially stronger had been able to show up and push them around, show up and take control of them, show up and set the terms for world intercourse, and that was an outcome not to be wished from these countries' point of view. And so that economic modernization was at least important from the point of view of national sovereignty, national power, national standing in the world. And that, in my view, explains at least as much about what's going on in Japan or Korea or even China as does a very narrow economic classification of how my standard of living improves this year.
If the goal is collective national strength, if that's the economical, what does that mean about the government role in setting economic policy in Asian countries?
It means different things in different countries. The one One trait that's more or less unique to Japan is that in 1868, when the Japanese began their rapid catch-up with the West, that's known as the Meiji Restoration, the government more or less took on a role in relationship to the rest of the economy that it still has, where you had very skillful, expert, well-trained bureaucrats, the flower of the nation's educational system, working in close collaboration with large industries to try to do things that are in the national good. And the part of American history that's most like this is not the U.S. of today, but the U.S. of World War II, when you had expert bureaucrats in the War Department and the U.S. government working with big companies to try to pursue the national welfare. What you find more broadly across Asia is not that specific history, but a general assumption that if you leave things to individuals just to make their own profit today, or companies to make their own profit this quarter, you as a nation may be worse off in the next 5 years. And so there is a coordinated effort with governments and businesses to invest artificially large amounts of money in productive capacity, to hold the savings rate artificially high. Artificial in the sense that people wouldn't do this themselves without this kind of shove in the back from government incentives. And that you find in varying ways throughout the region.
It gets very confusing. In Asian countries, you don't have as much price competition within the country, right? I mean, in America, people are always trying to undersell the next guy so that they can get the customers into their store. But in some instances, prices are kept unnaturally high in some Asian countries. And yet, when their products are in our country, they undersell us.
Well, I think this is a matter of a sort of shrewd understanding from the Asian perspective of how the world works, a shrewder understanding than we often display. If you complain to Japanese or Korean or Taiwanese manufacturers about this or that product, they will often say what American movie makers now say about the French, which is the American movie makers say to the French, look, nobody's making you watch this stuff. If your people don't want to watch Wayne's World, if you don't want to watch this or that TV show, don't watch it. We're not making you do it. You know, we think we have something people like and you know, be our guest. The Japanese or Asian producers say the same things about cars and cameras and computers and anything else, which is that if you don't want to buy this stuff, don't buy it. But they know that our market runs almost exclusively on price competition. We're not supposed to care where something is made as long as it's the best value for the least money. So they play by the rules that we observe in our market and nonetheless don't feel they have to sort of slavishly imitate those same rules in their own markets. One of the crucial bits of genius in the Asian system, one that is very rarely appreciated in the U.S., is the way that it has combined very harsh competition with a kind of guidance and a kind of insulation from competition. The kind of competition that is Darwinian and just unbelievable within these Asian systems is among their own competitors. The big Japanese auto companies try to kill each other every day, and the same for Korean electronics makers, but there are limits to that competition. It's like competition among the branches of the U.S. military. They compete hard with each other, but they realize they're all, in some sense, fundamentally on the same team.
Now, let me get to another fundamental difference between Asian economies and the American economic model, as you describe it in your Atlantic article. You say that in Asian countries, there's a different view of surprise and unpredictability. Key decisions there are not left to the market.
What I was trying to say, is something you could use this analogy for in our Western life. In much of our daily activities, you and I feel that we're guided by market forces. We sell our services to people who pay us for them, et cetera, et cetera. We make choices in the marketplace based on what's the best deal. And yet certain things we do are not subject to the market. We don't feel as if our citizenship is up for bids every day. Our family relationships are not put on the auction block every day to see which partner would be the best for us today and then change into another one tomorrow. I think in the Asian system as a whole, the proportions of those decisions are reversed from what they are here. There are many, many more decisions in the Asian model that are not really trusted to the market. A fairly narrow slice of them are driven by the market, whereas here we are principally market-driven. And the point I was trying to make is that our political system is based finally on a market-like belief that if individuals are free to pursue their own interests, the result will be some kind of good society. There, the Asian model, for better or worse, rightly or wrongly, is based on the opposite belief that if you define the good society for people collectively, if you define what their range of choice should be, then individual happiness will flow from that. Just as in a family, people define the parameters of choice, define the parameters of the market, and assume that individual happiness will flow from that control.
My guest is James Fallows, Washington editor of The Atlantic Monthly. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. James Fallows is my guest, author of the forthcoming book, Looking at the Sun, The Rise of the Asian System. Do you think that for America to compete in the global arena, that we have to start challenging some of our own philosophies so that we can compete head-on with countries that operate on different economic philosophies?
This isn't the question you're asking, but people who ask a similar question often say, oh, gee, do we have to imitate the Asian system? And the answer to that is, of course, not. It would be impossible in the U.S. and undesirable, too. What I think we do need to do is at least see the world clearly. We've been unnaturally uncurious about how different the world might be. What I mean by that is that we've assumed first that because of the Cold War, that countries were basically with us or against us. And since the Japanese were with us, they must be fundamentally similar to us. The Chinese for a long time were against us, so they were fundamentally different. Also, our American national myth, which was all the stronger after this country's domination after World War II, was that basically everybody else wanted to be like us. The natural state of social evolution was to be like the U.S. People don't often say it quite that baldly, but that's sort of the idea built into our political creed. And so we assumed that naturally Japan would become more and more like us and its politics, its women's rights, etc., as time went on. I think the main thing we have to do is recognize that the world may be more varied, more interesting, more diverse than we have allowed ourselves to think. To use the analogy of religion, it's as if we have been Christian missionaries sizing up other cultures by saying, well, that can't be right because that's not in the Bible, or that can't be right because we know that Moses didn't allow for this. And our economic ideology has had the same effect on us, I think.
Which economic ideology are we following now?
If you study economics in the English language, you think mainly that Adam Smith was somebody comparable to Isaac Newton in terms of having, you know, changed the world, that all subsequent knowledge flows from him. And even though Adam Smith in his actual writings had a much more kind of complicated view than we allow now, the simplified version that comes down from him is that competition is always good, and the more competition, the better. Government intervention is almost always bad. Individual welfare is paramount, and that if you let every individual pursue his welfare, the best good will come to the largest number. Now, most of those things, I think, are most of the time true, but they have a kind of falsely scientific standing in the Western world that partly affects how mathematics-bound economics has become, partly reflects the Nobel Prize in economics, but gives a kind of spurious precision to this economic theory.
Are you challenging the part of our economic philosophy that says government intervention is always bad?
Yes, I am. If you look at the version of economics that's on our editorial pages or in most political speeches, it asserts, well, you get the government in there, they're going to be picking winners and losers, you're going to have a big disaster, it's look what happened to the Russians, et cetera, et cetera. And certainly anybody who has seen the world knows that free markets, that market competition is an extremely powerful force that makes everybody do more than they might otherwise do. And yet, if you look, number one, at the history of the United States, you see that much of our economic growth has reflected an interaction of governmental and private influences. The railroads, for example, were built in the late 19th century, largely with either a complete prohibition or a very high tariff on imported British rails. And the idea was, this is how you'd help build the U.S. steel industry. You had the government laying out maps for people to follow. You had agricultural research. research, you had the aircraft industry, which was the aircraft and computer industries, which got their start almost exclusively on government contracts. And so the U.S. has never been a state-run society like the old Soviet Union, but it has had a kind of interaction. Also, if you look at the economies that have grown most in the last generation, they are those in East Asia, Japan, Korea, Taiwan. And it is impossible, if you are honest, to fit anything about them into the Adam Smith model because the government is right there in bed with the companies.
What about the part of our economic creed that says competition is always good? Do you challenge that?
I think that competition is always good in its place. I'll use first the Asian and then the American examples. The Asian example is that there are certain things that are not up for bids. The Koreans have wanted to have Korean-run machine tool industries. And so they say, we're going to give government subsidies for Korean companies doing this and have tariffs. But within that industry, people should compete like crazy. And they should compete to lower costs. They should compete for the highest possible quality. And people who come out second or third are not going to get help from us. It's only the winners who will get help. And so a mixture of competition and some kind of buffer seems to have been useful for them. In the American experience, it's a much harder thing, I think, for us to resolve because, indeed, I think this is the long-term problem of American democracy. Our theories, both our political theories and our economic theories, say basically that competition is always good. Not that it's usually good, but that it's always good. Individuals should always compete for personal liberty and for political influence. Companies should always compete in whatever way possible. We should break them up whenever they threaten not to compete. And yet, when we're thinking as people, not as theorists, but as actual human beings, we realize there are some kinds of things where competition is damaging, that there are certain kinds of free expression that are coarsening to our entire culture. There's certain effects on family structure, that if you just let each individual free to pursue his or her own maximum welfare, it does harm to the society in the long run. We have a very hard time dealing with that because our theory allows only for the competition. We have no theory of these collective, non-competitive interests. And that's why this democracy has more ups and downs than some others.
What are you suggesting as a way to modulate this total belief in competition as a good force?
I suppose if I had the perfect answer to that, I would be a more influential and better-known person than I am today. My ambitions for the moment are to have it recognized as the problem that we face, that there is a sort of what the economists would call a market failure in our theoretical equipment. We have this very elaborate economic set of theories. We have a well-established set of political theories, and yet there's something that we can all recognize that they don't cope with. And so there's something we have to figure out.
How do you think the debate on health care reform is being influenced by what perceptions are of the American economic system? You know, if you look at economy as an almost religion that you follow.
It fits into it in a strange way. On the one hand, it's being sold in Washington politics as being part of the solution to economic problems. If our health care costs are a lot higher than the Japanese or the Germans, then our companies have a harder time competing. In another way, and in probably more important subliminal way, the health care debate does represent the biggest step away from the free market model I've seen in a long time. I remember as a high school debater in the 1960s, the debate topic would be Medicare. And then the axis of the argument was, is this socialized medicine or is this not socialized medicine? It's amazing how little talk we've heard about the socialized medicine specter in the last few months since President Clinton announced his plan, which suggests to me that there is a kind of consensus that the market-driven solution to this problem has not really worked and that some kind of intervention is necessary. So I think this may be the major illustration of a step away from pure free marketism in modern politics.
Now, how, what would your critique be about how America is conducting itself in all these trade talks?
I think the conduct of the GATT talks, to the extent that anyone can stand to think about it or hear about it, has been has been better modulated than the NAFTA debate. The NAFTA debate was largely presented as good versus evil, all versus nothing. My heart sank when Vice President Gore on his debate with Ross Perot hauled out the picture of Smoot and Hawley, because that meant, you know, if you're against NAFTA, you want the Great Depression. You want to just close off everything. And the world is more varied than that. In the GATT talks, interestingly, things have not really been presented that way. Partly that's because the agreement itself is such a mixed bag of, you know, not a million, but thousands of different provisions involving everything from how much rice the Japanese will agree to buy to what kinds of pharmaceuticals patents the U.S. can have protected in India. And because it is such a big mess, it resists any attempt to say, oh, this is one big theory of free trade. What it's much more like is some kind of public works bill rolling through the U.S. Congress, where everybody gets some little provision. On the whole, people can say this GATT agreement makes for freer trade around the world and will probably enrich everybody somewhat. But it is so messy and Christmas tree-like that nobody can say, oh, here is a shining example of pristine, theoretically perfect free trade.
What do you think is the trade philosophy of President Clinton and his trade representative, Mickey Cantor? Do you think their philosophies differ from previous presidential administrations?
I think they differ in a positive way. During the Reagan and Bush years, it was necessary to argue about first principles. And the first principle was this. Principle was whether the rest of the world should be assumed to operate by exactly the same rules that Americans preached to themselves. And so if there was evidence that the Japanese or French or Germans were protecting some industry, you had to argue in the Reagan and Bush years, can this really be? Would any nation really protect something? Could they be so foolish as to do that? And anyway, should we care about it because we know that responding might hurt our consumers? That argument seems no longer necessary in the Clinton years. There is an assumption that the world does have a mixture of trading practices, and we need to sort of find out how we can get along with them and live with them. One, if I can be indulged in, sort of geographical psychoanalysis, I think one reason for that may be that Bill Clinton is a Southerner. In the last two generations, most of America, especially the coastal parts of America, has been allowed to have a non-tragic view of economics. They've been able to think that, yeah, economics always produces winners all around. The main part of the country that has seen the negative-sum aspects of economics, that have seen that economic power can be used for political power as well and can make some people lose, is the American South. The American South has been largely at the mercy of the North for the last century or so, and people who grow up there know that. So I think that Clinton comes to office with a more tragic imagination about economics than, say, George Bush had.
James Fallows is Washington editor of The Atlantic Monthly. His final article in his series on the economy is in the January edition. His book, More Like Us, The Rise of the Asian System, will be published early next year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.